Our first speaker is Fran Beal, known to many of us. Her activism began with SNCC and the struggle in the South during the 60s. She was a founding member of the Third World Women's Alliance. She was a former associate editor of Black Scholar magazine and is currently a freelance writer on national black politics. Welcome, Fran.
I've been asked today to kind of give a little historical background, sort of to set the tone for our discussion. Just in terms of thinking about presentation, I had to kind of take my mind out of my head and kind of throw it back 25 or 30 years to try to remember what the situation was like there, because a lot of young people don't realize that a lot of the very question that we're dealing today would not automatically have been on a conference agenda of this time. It was not considered an issue. No one had really raised the question in a mass type of a way yet. Obviously, in the history of black women, there were a number of individual women who had taken part in the suffragette movement and had taken part in other movements, and certainly had spoken within the black community around the situation of women. At the time, though, when a number of us were involved in the civil rights movement, for obvious reasons, the key thing that we were fighting was white supremacy. I was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. That's what SNCC stands for. I know some young people have never heard that spelled out, but that's what SNCC meant. SNCC was initially conceived of by Ella Baker, who is a great black woman, who the mother of the civil rights movement, and someone that all of us in SNCC, male and female alike, loved and revered very much. And I'd like us just to take a moment to give recognition to Ella Baker. People may know that the SNCC was a student or organization, and originally the idea with the spontaneous sit-in movement was to try to bring all of this together into an organization. And the adults who were in the SCLC, which is the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, were interested in kind of gathering all this spontaneous energy of the youth under their aegis. Ella Baker, on the other hand, had an extremely open and questioning mind at all times, and she herself had been struggling in the behind the scenes very much in first in the NAACP and then in SCLC, never achieved the kind of national recognition except for people who were actually in the movement who really knew what were going on. In any case, Ella Baker was the impetus for calling the conference in 1960 in Greensboro, in which they hoped the conference was called by SCLC, and they hoped that a student arm of the SCLC would emerge from this. But, you know, students being students and youth being youth, decided that they did not want to be the youth arm of the SCLC and wanted to form an independent organization. And that was essentially the birth of SNCC as an independent organization and not as a youth arm of the SCLC. And this actually set the groundwork for the radical politics that was to emerge in relationship to SNCC as opposed to the SCLC. Not that they weren't both radical organizations in the context of the politics of the time. In any case, getting to the Third World Women's Alliance, the Third World Women's Alliance was actually founded in 1969. Its name at that time was the SNCC Black Women's Liberation Committee, and it was actually founded by several members, female members of SNCC, who were attending a SNCC national staff meeting. Women who participated in that came from LA, Detroit, New York, and Washington, DC, as I recall. And there was a lot of debate within SNCC whether we should have such an organization. Some people felt, well, there's no need for a separate women's organization. It's divisive, and the role of the women is whatever they do in the organization. However, there were a lot of things going on external to SNCC where women felt that there were some very backward ideas being propagated around the concept of women, and that, in fact, it would be a very good idea for us to have an explicit women's organization that specifically took up the gender-related, although we didn't use that term at the time, but the specific problems that women face in society at large, as citizens, within the civil rights movement, and amongst ourselves as women. And in fact, the Black Women's Liberation Committee was founded with not exactly in cooperation with SNCC, but it was voted on at the 1969 December SNCC staff meeting, and they said, yeah, go ahead, take the ball and run with it, essentially. After that, we evolved into the Third World Women's Alliance a couple of years later because we were approached in New York City by a number of Puerto Rican sisters who said, there is no such organization in the Puerto Rican community. We would be interested in working with you. We think that our unities with the Black women are more significant than whatever cultural or ethnic difference there may that may exist. And in fact, we had quite a debate in the organization at that time, and it was the sort of, and a number of, when we finally voted on it, the vast majority of women voted to become a third world organization and to change the name of the organization to reflect that composition to the Third World Women's Alliance. There were a few Black women who were more nationalist oriented, who felt that we were, that Black women were so distinct that we should not have an organization. However, some of us felt so sorry for our Puerto Rican sister. I mean, we were 50 strong, and there they were 4 strong, you know, we felt after a series of discussions, we felt that there actually were more unities. Both of us belonged to ethnic or racial groups of which we were activists, and in which we had been struggling along with our brothers for some time. At the same time, we were women, and we were becoming conscious of the fact that within those movements and in society at large, we were not equal, and we did not like it. So that is essentially the birth of the Third World Women's Alliance, and we began publishing a newspaper in 1972 called Triple Jeopardy, which of which I was the editor, and its Triple Jeopardy stood for what the general political orientation of the Third World Women's Alliance was, and that was the fight against racism, the fight against imperialism, and the fight against sexism. So that was the triple jeopardy. We said those are the three evils that are essentially pouring down on our heads and which we have to take up. Now, and we did take up a number of struggles, not only amongst the nationalists who we thought had a number of very bad ideas about women, 10 steps behind, and so on and so forth, and I'm going to go into that a little bit more. One thing I have to say about it, I feel very free kind of speaking in this thing, but I remember the first time I went to speak on the abortion issue. It was in 1971. It was up in Harlem, and it was amongst a group of Muslims. And now, I was a person who had been in the civil rights movement, had been beaten up several times by the Alabama state cops, so I knew fear. But I'll tell you, even though there was more danger in the final analysis from the Alabama state cops, I don't think I felt any more fear than when I said, yes, I would do that. And it was one of the first public speeches I had ever made, and there I was, you know, young and not experienced in doing speaking, but I felt very determined about this because I felt so strongly about it. I felt very strongly about the abortion issue, both for philosophical and for personal reasons. I went to a high school with very few black women, went on to college, and there were five of us from that high school that went on to college. By Thanksgiving vacation, when we came back, only four came back because one had died from an illegal abortion. So to me, abortion was what was, you know, killing women in this country. And all of the brouhaha about abortion being genocide of black people did not relate to the reality that I knew. So for me, there was no question about the question of the right of black women to abortion. And we, the Third World Women's Alliance, also became very involved in doing statistical studies to show, I mean, people remember, you didn't have the right to abortion. And in some states, you didn't even have the right, like, to contraceptive devices. So things were really bad as far as, you know, women being able to control even their biological functions, you know, at any level. In any case, the Third World Women's Alliance began to take up a number of struggles both within the women's movement as a whole, because we felt that we were women. We felt that we had just as many concerns as a number of the white women around there, but we felt that their lack of concern and orientation towards minority women, black and Puerto Rican women in particular, and lack of concern on the class questions of working class and poor women made it very difficult sometimes to work with these other women. So we often found ourselves in the context of the women's movement raising the anti-racist banner. On the other hand, the brothers in the various organizations that some of us involved in did not see the issue of women's liberation or women's equality, which we used to like to talk about, as something that was that they should put on the front burner. After all, the struggle against racism was the more important struggle, and to raise the question of women's liberation would be to divide the struggle, and in order to have unity, shut up. So, this was something that we felt was not exactly what we wanted to do, however. So eventually we actually began we became a very, very active organization, and it was a time when lots of things were happening, not only in the women's movement, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement. It was very easy to bring people together. You would call it, I remember one time we called a demonstration when Amical Cabral was killed. And overnight, we had 700 women just through telephone calling to come out and demonstrate in front of the Portuguese embassy. It gives you a sense of the motion of the time and how people could actually move, a sense of that, you know, when you're in a movement, a lot of consciousness is there on a lot of issues. And on the international issue, we actually were very, very active in relationship to support for our sisters in Vietnam, support for what was going on in the Southern Africa anti-colonial struggles, the Portuguese, then Portuguese colonies, Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau, and of course, our sisters in Southern Africa. Cuba also played an important role for us in relationship to our international consciousness. Now, one of the things I wanted to do was actually to step back a little bit to talk about why I think it was actually out of an organization like SNCC rather than an organization like the Muslims that a movement for women's liberation actually emerged. Because just like James Cone talked yesterday about the different dynamics that gave rise to a Malcolm X in the Northern Urban Center and the different dynamics that gave rise to a Martin Luther King in the Southern dynamic, I think had played an impact on why it was the Southern arm of the freedom movement that gave rise to an organization like the Third World Women's Alliance. And I think there were two major influences, one group being international and one group being domestic. Let me start with the
I wrote it down on the international. Let me start on the domestic side first. In many ways, the black women in the South were the backbone of the civil rights movement. Not only did they, you know, make the tea and the coffee and the cones and all the things, as you know, in the particularly in the black church, black women are often the ones that are doing all the work. And so it was not surprising that we have, like, you know, people, women like Annie Devine, who you may not have, have heard of, all the way to Ella Baker and Fannie Lou Hamer, or that Rosa Parks started, you know, the whole Montgomery boycott. Within SNCC, there were, which considered itself kind of a cadre organization, it would go, so the whole organization considered itself leaders in that sense. And black women were called upon to do things that they had not been called upon to do in the past. Speak in front of groups, go door to door to try to get people to register to vote. And the other thing that was very clear, at least as far as the state was concerned, they did not beat us any less than they beat the black men. So that we had to suffer for taking up the banner of the struggle against white supremacy with the same types of assaults that our black brothers, fathers, nephews, et cetera, also did. So that was a very clear thing to us. At the same time, it was also, as the movement developed, it became very clear, particularly to the youth in SCLC, that women had really no place in the adult organization of SCLC. But we were the youth organization, and we did not think that we should just be following in the tracks of the old leadership. In this sense, then, the SNCC and the civil rights movement gives birth to not only a challenge to white supremacy, but a challenge to a number of ideas and traditional ways of doing things, not the least of which was leadership. So, in the SCLC, it was very much set up along the church lines, and there was very little democratic input from the base. You know, just like a church, the minister is the word of God, and he passes it down, and the women generally follow through, and so on and so forth. And there's a hierarchy, of course, but there's no real democratic input. One of the reasons SNCC did not want to be a part, this is my assessment of it, of course, there might be other SNCC members who have different assessment of it, was because of the concept of leadership. Here we were out getting our butts beat and getting our heads knocked in by the cops. At the same time, it seemed a contradiction to then come back to an organization that didn't have a full democratic process within it. So we didn't say, okay, here in the organization, we're going to be hierarchical, just like the society at large, and then go out and challenge white power structures. That was a contradiction that right from the beginning, the youth in SNCC saw. Now, it had positive aspects in the sense that it challenged traditional concepts of leadership. It challenged the concept of just the great leader, although we had our great leaders too, of course. You know, you can't clean up your act just overnight. But at least philosophically, we had this idea. One of the ideas that also came out of this, which I am now 50 years old, I don't think I could, I would really vote against it now, but when I was 18, 19, and 20, I had the physical energy for it, and that was the idea of consensus. That means that you would have a meeting go on until you reach consensus, so that we then all go out together. Well, I'm here to tell you, at 20, I can go to 12-hour meetings, and I could go, and the longest meeting I ever attended in that period of time was a 24-hour meeting in Atlanta, Georgia. But we did get consensus eventually. You know, those who could stay awake won the day, you know. In any case, though, you could actually see, looking back, when how having a woman's consciousness, how that type of leadership can actually work very much against women who are principally responsible for children and so on. Not that we'd had that many children at the time, because as I said, we were, you know, pretty pretty young. But the whole question then, I mean, the point I'm trying to make here is that we were challenging not only white supremacy, we were also challenging concepts of leadership, tactics in the struggle, the whole concept of the sit-ins as opposed to, you know, direct action versus, you know, just asking the Democrats to please give us our rights. And so there was a whole bunch of challenges going on and discussions that would go on through the night and talking about our roots and where we came from and where we're going and those kinds of things. So it was a very exciting type of thing. Now, if you put that together with the objective reality that SNCC women were actually taking on roles in the struggle outside the organization that they had never taken on before, that were non-traditional female roles of leadership, you could see, since, you know, we love to discuss things, the question of what is the role of women in the movement would eventually emerge. And it did begin to emerge, not only because of what I've just said, but also because there began to seep into a SNCC some ideas which we, some of the women, considered fairly reactionary. Part of the whole expansion process was, in terms of the seeking of roots, was, of course, looking at Africa and what was going on there. The problem was there were certain men in particular that looked back at 15th century Africa, whereas the women in the organization looked back at 20th century Africa. This was a very important difference, because the men looked back at what they were, at least, I don't know where they got their information from, but their views of Africa, of women walking 10 steps behind, supporting their men, women who basically, you know, babies and home and hearth, women who were expected to just be a support, a nurturer, you know, all the things that that guy in the last youth sentence was talking about how he loved on that march about women drove me up the wall, because that was precisely the kind of ideology that we thought was incorrect there. The other, as I said, the other influence on us was international. In this regard, we were looking at 20th century Africa. And SNCC actually had a number of international contacts and went, you know, visited Africa and became very concerned about Africa, which is very interesting because in relationship to Malcolm X, there was a sort of a parallel development of an interest in our roots, one that was emerging in the North, but one that was emerging also in the South out of the civil rights movement, because it was a whole part of this, like challenging and thinking about new ideas and where we came from and where we were going to go. So, however, our contacts in terms of Africa tended to be with the more revolutionary government. So we had contacts and began to study the works of people like Amilcar Cabral from Guinea-Bissau, people, you know, the MPLA in Mozambique played a very, very important role for us. And of course, in Angola, we were very, we felt very close attachment to what was going on. In other words, these countries were still fighting a war of liberation against Portugal, for those of you who may not have been born at that time. And we were a part of the beginnings of a solidarity movement in this country around those struggles. And certainly we had contact, we got contact through the United Nations with people who were struggling against apartheid in South Africa, particularly through members of the ANC, the African National Congress. Then a number of our members also went to Cuba because, you know, it's a black, you know, we saw that as a principally black nation, and they had really come through a revolution. We were just very fascinated with revolutionary ideas. The women were in particularly fascinated because it seemed like there was a correlation between those who were truly struggling for liberation and those who had a really good position on women. So we had a very strong pull towards becoming more revolutionary minded because it was, there was a correlation between those movements that were progressive and those movements that were talking about ridding themselves of backward ideas on women. Obviously, we love this because while some of our nationalist friends were talking about having babies for the revolution and going back to the home, we were able then to point to the motherland and talk about what was happening to the new African woman. And this was a very powerful tool, because we had not yet gone back into our own history. And there was a lot being written about this, because changes were taking place as women participated in the struggles for national liberation, and there were struggles that went on. I recall finding an essay that had been written by Sékou Touré, who was the head of Guinea, in which he was talking about the role of women. And it was a very interesting piece, because he said, when the white colonial powers came, they oppressed the entire population of it, but they also oppressed, you know, the good and healthy cultural aspects of the population. But do not think that all of the cultural manifestations that we had when the colonials came were good. They were not. And on one level, he talked about the role of women in the country, and how important it was for women to grow and expand to build the nation. And he came up with a phrase which I later used as a title for an essay I wrote called Slave of a Slave. And I called my uncle Slave of a Slave No More, because that kind of encapsulated the concept that in a colonial situation, you can be slaves, but then the slaves can have slaves. And we thought that really encapsulated for us the relationship that we often had in these civil rights, in the civil rights movement. So we're very much, as I said, influenced by things that were going on around the world. And certainly the struggle of the sisters in Vietnam for national liberation and the roles that they were playing gave us a very big kick. I have to say, I don't know what it is about youth and their, you know, their fascination with guns, but to see sisters going around with guns and shooting them at, you know, imperialists, it was really like nice. Okay. Anyway, I said all this. Anyway, we had a lot of talking going on about freedom, democracy, and, you know, changing the world, changing ourselves. And, of course, all this talking impacted women very much. One of the ideas that I wanted to, I'm going to close now because I think I'm sort of coming to the end. I just wanted to give you a flavor of some of the things. We took up all the issues that, many of which are still on the agenda, the question of, you know, reproductive rights, the question of equal pay for equal work, you know, the question of women's role in society, women's role in leadership, and essentially, I haven't changed that much from that period of time. I think that we have a big struggle in front of us, and male or female, you know, we need to all unite in order to push that struggle forward. Not only that, there are particular problems, which I'm sure some of the other sisters here were going to be going into, that we face as women, and those issues keep us from participating fully in society, developing ourselves to the fullest extent, and we need to support each other in trying to move forward. Unfortunately, over the last decade, I've seen some step backwards in relationship to the attitude towards women amongst our youth, but some amongst other sectors of society. I think that's a reflection of the general move to the right that we have suffered under Reaganism. But on the other hand, I think the positive thing is, at least from a verbal point of view, there is no progressive organization in this country which does not uphold the concept of the equality of women. How that works out in practice is not necessarily a very, it is not always what we would like, and more struggle needs to be done on that, but believe me, it's a big difference from when we were starting back in the 1960s to raise this question, and I think that it is a tribute to the women, not only, I mean, put myself outside of that, but really to the women in who stood up and really insisted on taking this, not only the question of racism to the women's movement, but the question of sexism into the civil rights movement. Because without those veterans, we would not be where we are today. Thank you.